This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Colonel William Anderson. We are at Fort Walton Beach, Florida, on the 22nd of September, year 2000, at approximately 8:45. All right, Colonel Anderson, would you begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of your early life?
Okay, I was born and raised in Meadville, Pennsylvania, which is just south of Lake Erie in the northwestern part of the state of Pennsylvania. Went to high school there and started college there at Allegheny College. Finished up a first year, and it was into the second half, or the half of the second year, when the Korean War was getting pretty hot and heavy. And I was advised that I was coming up at the top of the draft list, so my choice was to whether I wanted to go in the Army or the Air Force, and I decided that I'd kind of like to go in the Air Force. So I enlisted in and came in service in January of 1951. Went through basic training in Southern Texas, Lackland, in Wichita Falls, and my first assignment was up to Columbus, Ohio, and then Westover, Massachusetts, and I was a mechanic, a gunsight mechanic, and an F-86 outfit there. Of course, I didn't have my college degree, and I'd always wanted to fly, and one of my supervisors suggested I apply for pilot training, so I did and got accepted. Started pilot training in 52 and graduated and got my wings in 1953. And from there, I went to San Marcos, Texas to teach Army officers how to fly for 3 years, and accumulated a lot of time in a short duration, and got a chance to go to B-47s when they closed up the base at San Marcos, and got into the bomber business in SAC. Mm-hmm. And stayed in the bomber business in SAC, flying B-47s and B-52s, various locations. And then the Vietnam War was going strongly. In 1967, I got an assignment to go to Vietnam. It was kind of an interesting assignment. It had been a while since I'd flown fighters, so I had to go back through F-100 gunnery school at Luke. Mm-hmm. Because in order to be a FAC, forward air controller, and control American troops, you had to be a fighter pilot qualified.
Okay.
Be current on the gunnery range and current on tactics. So I had to go back through that school. After finished up the training at Luke, I went to counterinsurgency school here at Hurlburt.
Mm-hmm.
I finished that up. And then another kid and I, a young captain, and I was a major at the time, we got assigned to go to Fort Lewis, Washington to train with an Army battalion that was getting ready to go to Vietnam. And the purpose of this program was to kind of educate the Army people on how to use air power. Many of them didn't know how to use it. Some of them were afraid of it, you know, dangers of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so our job was to teach this battalion, and then with the idea that we would go to Vietnam with this battalion and eventually work with them in country.
Mm-hmm.
This was about the time the Tet Offensive was starting in 68. So when we went to Vietnam, the battalion was supposed to go to Chu Lai, which is up in northern I Corps. But they got diverted at sea to go help out in Saigon area for the Tet Offensive. So we never did work with that battalion.
Oh, that's true.
But then we got checked out in O-2's aircraft at, in country, and then went to Chu Lai, where we worked with the AmeriCal Division. That was the largest Army division ever formed.
Mm-hmm.
I served as the Assistant Division ALO for about 2 months with the AmeriCal Division, which was pretty interesting because it got me familiar with all the area of the AmeriCal Division. And then I went to the 11th Brigade and served as the ALO for the 11th Brigade then for the rest of my year tour, which was about 8 months left.
Okay. What did you think about that project to integrate air assets with a battalion in training before going to Vietnam?
It was excellent, and it gave them an awful lot of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
The Army people on the ground in the areas that we worked, they had to call on you for air support when they were in trouble, when they were in a firefight, and they had to have confidence that you knew what you were doing and that the fighters that you were putting in knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that what we did in the AmeriCal Division was kind of a big contrast to some other facts that I've talked to, where the Army people were afraid to put in air around them.
Mm-hmm.
For fear that they would get hit. The Army people we worked with were just the opposite. They had no fear. In fact, we had to go to the other extreme to convince them, you can't put in napalm 50 meters from you. That's too close. You've got to back up. And they had it in their mind that the Air Force would never miss a target. And so it was a reverse education problem for us. We had to convince them sometimes, hey, they're not really that good all the time, so you've got to be a little careful. And that happened many times with me. And sometimes they'd lie to you. You'd tell them to move back, and they'd say, okay, we've moved back. And then you'd drop in the ordnance on the target and then have them mark their position again, and they'd never moved. So,
did that ever result in friendly casualties?
No, we never had any. But we were close. But and in most cases, they were satisfied with it. But we had to be careful that they didn't lie to us. And we'd make them mark their position, and we'd make them mark it again, saying, sure, they weren't lying. But the primary duty, for a forward air controller, that was different than a lot of the other. The Coveys and the Nails and those, they flew up in country in Laos and Cambodia, and they really did not work with the people on the ground that much unless they happened to be there. When we took off for our mission, we had to know where every battalion, every company were in the field, and they'd be scattered throughout the jungle and back in off the coast, and you had to know where they were, and you made contact with each of those units every day, and then if they got in trouble, they would call you, and we'd have troops in contact every day someplace, and you'd bring in air strikes. You'd call in the air, mark the target, they'd tell you what kind of a situation they had on the ground, and then you'd work the airstrikes. The forward air controller had complete authority over ordnance that was put in country. Nobody could put in ordnance without approval of the FAC, at least in our division area.
Okay.
So that portion of it. Then we each brigade was assigned special forces camps that they were responsible for supporting. In the 11th Brigade, we had six special forces camps that we would occasionally visit, and we were their backup support. We've had many firefights with the Viet Cong and the NVA trying to overrun one of those outposts, which were manned by Green Berets. Primarily a special forces camp was about five or six Green Berets, and then maybe 1,000 civilian irregular defense forces. And it was their job to give them the Green Berets' job to give them a fortified position and help train them to defend the village. So a lot of our activity was in that area. I was fortunate that, and I think maybe it might have been unique within the AmeriCal Division, at least it was in the 11th Brigade, the brigade commander flew his command and control helicopter from daylight to dark every day, and he checked on every unit that he had in the field. And if he had a unit that was in a firefight or needed help, he would evacuate wounded with his helicopter. Well, he wanted a forward air controller with him when he flew those missions. So I had four FACs assigned to the brigade, and one of us would fly 1 week out of every month with him in his command and control chopper.
Sorry, go ahead.
So that was very interesting. Many times we'd get left on the ground because there wasn't enough room in the chopper for the wounded and to haul out, so we'd stay on the ground, and sometimes I stayed on for 2 days before they ever could get back in to get me out. So I ended up fighting on the ground with the Army units, and that was interesting experience.
Well, let's take a step back. Okay. I want to come back to those experiences because that sounds pretty unique, especially from a FAC perspective, to be actually on the ground and fighting. The training that you received when you first went into the Air Force and as your training progressed as an officer and a pilot, how would you evaluate that training? Do you think that in the various stages of your Air Force career, the training was adequate to the task?
Yes, it was. Of course, what we had to do in Vietnam as a forward air controller was very specialized. So the Air Force training up until that point hadn't focused in that kind of thing. And I've been flying bombers, and now I'm going to go down and give, fly 50 feet off the ground at 120 miles an hour and give air support to people on the ground. So it was a completely different kind of training.
And the counterinsurgency training that you received here at Hurlburt Field,
that gave you an idea of what it was going to be like over there. But, like any training, it's a little different than when you actually get your feet on the ground.
Well, that was in 1967 that you received that training here. Do you remember much about the coursework and what they discussed in terms of, I mean, by that time they have to be integrating information from Vietnam, from the field, from other FACs that are flying here, from other Air Force pilots flying special operations missions and in support of special operations. Do you remember any specific things they told you about Vietnam that stick out?
Very little specifics about in-country. It was primarily focused around troop movements, how the troops would move normally on the ground, mm-hmm. what the terrain was like, map reading, mm-hmm. Being able to locate yourself. Of course, no radio nav aids, and so you got a coordinates of a ground unit, and you're out in the middle of sometimes triple canopy jungle, mm-hmm. and you have to be pretty good at map reading in order to figure out where they're at.
Yeah. I would imagine the use of very prominent terrain features and things of that nature was commonplace.
Yeah.
And from the air, that's much easier.
Yeah.
What about the political and social aspects of the insurgency and of counterinsurgency, and specifically what was happening in Vietnam? Was there much discussion about the ins and outs of the complexities of Vietnam?
Some that, trying to describe to us what the political atmosphere was. In the South, they were contending with the guerrilla type, the Viet Cong, mm-hmm. and one of the problems in that area that the Viet Cong didn't have a uniform. He might be hoeing in a rice paddy 1 minute, and the next minute he's carrying an AK-47 and shooting. So, very unusual that you could distinguish. You couldn't. It was weird. Some of the times you'd pick them up, and we'd pick them up in the helicopter, what we call military age males. So you figured that the individual was either, he was the right age, he should be either in the South Vietnamese Army or he was a Viet Cong. Mm-hmm. And so you'd pick him up, and you could sometimes tell them, some of them would be loaded with calluses across the top of their shoulders from mm-hmm. carrying packs and stuff on the trail. Mm-hmm. And so this guy was either a Viet Cong or hauling for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most difficult problem. You always heard after the war and during the war about innocent civilians. Well, it was pretty hard to find and distinguish innocent civilians. Everybody has heard the story of the little kids that threw hand grenades in the shoebox and stuff like that. And that went on.
Mm-hmm.
Roads would be mined the next morning after they were swept. And there'd be a little hooch right across the street from where the mine went off and blew up one of our vehicles, mm-hmm. and the people would say, no, I didn't see anything. And most of the time they responded like that out of fear,
mm-hmm.
because in country, at night, the Viet Cong owned an awful lot of villages.
Mm-hmm.
During the day, they'd be out of there, but they'd be in getting supplies at night, and a great deal of fear from the people, and you could sympathize with them because there was nobody there to protect them, so they better go along with them. So it was very difficult to find out, to really know who were the good guys and who were the bad guys.
What about prior to that training, and in terms of your own political awareness through the news, through magazines, and other measures, perhaps other officers and personnel that you met that had come back from Vietnam, what did you think personally, based on that information, was going on in Vietnam, and why was the United States involved?
Well, we thought we were involved, and I'd rather not get into the political aspects. Do you feel that a country that was not able to defend itself was being overrun, mm-hmm. or infiltrated by a communist led group,
mm-hmm.
and that was our feeling, that very similar to what we had achieved in Korea, the situation there,
mm-hmm.
and that primarily you were concerned with helping these people defend themselves if they in fact wanted to be defended, and that was the feeling that we had.
What has your perspective regarding that particular aspect, has it changed over time, and in terms of just in your knowledge of works of history and documentation and things like that that's been revealed or come out since then?
No, I don't think so. I think they did not want to be infiltrated by the communists,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they had any choice. It was just too overwhelming for them to fight, and they had to survive. We had it, and then in Vietnam and Indochina had been going through this for so long. I remember one time we were planning a support mission for the South Vietnamese Army movement,
mm-hmm.
and it was supposed to be a weekend planning session, and we started on a Friday and we worked all day Friday. 5 o'clock Friday night, we're just into the meat of the things getting going, And all the South Vietnamese officers got up and walked out of the meeting and left. And we said, where are they going? And they said, well, they're going home to their families this weekend. And they'll be back Monday morning and we're gone. And we were quite upset. And we said, you know, what's going on? And they said, well, you've got to remember, they've been doing this for 20 years. And, you know, what's another day? You know. So, you know, they had an attitude, and you can understand what they've been going through.
Well, that brings up an interesting point. And in terms of the American policy of rotation, and every person having a 365-day tour, and some people signing up for additional tours and spending more time in country, but for a majority of Americans, it was a one-year tour. You know, there's the old cliche now that we didn't fight a 12-year or 15-year war, we fought a one-year war 15 times or whatever. Whereas the Vietnamese experience was quite different. They were there for the duration. How much of an impact do you think that had? And do you think, what is your personal view of that rotation system? Do you think it was, again, adequate to the task, what we were trying to accomplish?
I don't think you do quite as good a job when you have to rotate. However, I was married and I had three children, and mm-hmm. and for me, boy, a year was you know, mm-hmm. long enough to spend it. Mm-hmm. Unlike World War II, where guys were gone for 3 years, you know. I think there's pros and cons to both ways. I think some of the soldiers in World War II were really burnt out mm-hmm. after the first or second year, and maybe not nearly as effective. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that in a war, in a battle, that about 1% of your people do any fighting. You know, the rest of them are just kind of hunkering down, trying to save themselves. And I from some of the battles I've seen and been involved in myself on the ground, that's kind of the way it is. Mm-hmm. Very small percentage of the people are really doing the fighting. And those people get burnt out pretty quick.
Okay. So, but in terms of what you think, now, as a senior member of a senior officer, do you think that a rotation system like we implemented in Vietnam is militarily effective, and or do you think that regardless of the military effectiveness, we have to take the political considerations into account?
Yeah, I think the rotation is the best way to go, because you always have, if you've got younger people and with maybe no families, they can certainly volunteer to stay in and do another tour, mm-hmm. and they would become very valuable instruments in training other people, training the new people. Mm-hmm. But I think you almost have to have a rotation now.
Okay. Well, when you got to Vietnam, why don't you go ahead and describe your trip over? You know, when you left the United States, you know, what did your family think, first of all, when you learned you were going to Vietnam? Did you volunteer to go?
Yes.
Okay. You know, what did your family think? Your husband, yeah. You've got three children. You know, that lot of uncertainty and concern, I'm sure. And then describe the trip over.
Well, when I decided I was going to go, I had an awful lot of friends that were going at the same time. And I decided that it's very frustrating. I had spent at that time nearly 20 years. And your training to be an effective combat weapon, but you never get to find out if you really are.
Mm-hmm.
I pulled 16 years of alert with a nuclear weapon, and you're a deterrent, and you're sitting there and you think, well, you know, I've been trained to do this. It's all I've ever done is train for this. I wonder if I can really do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, going to Vietnam then was a little different. You got to put into to action what you've been training for, and it was kind of a test, really. The family wasn't too upset. Flying is not the safest profession, and I've been flying all over the world in bombers, and so the family kind of adjusted to that, and they figured that the Vietnam thing was something that we needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very supportive. When I left, flew over to Vietnam, we landed in Saigon, or we landed at Saigon, and my first indoctrination was getting off the airplane, and we went into what would be your base operations.
Mm-hmm.
And about half the building was blown away because the Tet was in progress.
Yeah.
And so it was a very desolate looking place.
Mm-hmm.
And when I checked in, I told the guy where I was going, and to Chulai, which was up in northern I Corps. I had no idea where it was. And he said, no, you're going to NKP in Thailand. And I said, no, I said, I can't be, because I've just got done training with this Army unit in the States, and the purpose is we're to stay together. Well, we argued for a few minutes, and finally said, okay, you can go to Chulai if you want to, I don't care. And I said, well, do you mind telling me where it is? And he said, it's up north. And I said, well, how do I get there? And we go out here in the flight line to see if you can catch a plane going that way. So you're pretty much on your own. If it hadn't been for collecting your pay, mm-hmm. you probably could have stayed hid for a whole year over there. Nobody knew it. So then I landed at Da Nang, and that was where our headquarters of 20th Task was. And then they called down to Chulai, and somebody came up in an O2 and picked me up and flew me back down into Chulai. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting transition there.
What were your first impressions coming off the aircraft at, I assume it was Continent?
Yeah.
Yeah. What were your first impressions getting off that plane when you went and landed in March of 68?
Well, I was concerned, because when you, it's just like getting off an airliner at a passenger terminal and the place is half blown away. You kind of wonder, hey, this isn't too secure. What's going on here? We lost control, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Tet was in full progress, mm-hmm. and we had lost control.
That brings up an interesting point, militarily and politically, and also with regard to the media. And, of course, just prior to you leaving, in late 67, in November of 67, General Westmoreland had come back to the United States and been, of course, given briefings to Congress and the President and in front of the media, and had been stating that, you know, the light's at the end of the tunnel. You know, this war will be over soon. We've all but won. And then January 68, Tet hits. You landed at Tonset in March of 68, half the airport's blown away. You know, what were your impressions in terms of the military leadership and even the political leadership? And here you are getting thrown in the middle of this in such an interesting period of the war. And, of course, the turning point in terms of political will for the United States. So a lot of people allege that that's when the United States decided they didn't want to fight this war anymore.
We were shocked, I think, probably, is at the extent of the Tet Offensive. But then we gradually learned, that this was expected and there was a big offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And many people consider the Tet Offensive as a kind of a victory that kind of turned us around. And it really wasn't. It was a defeat for them,
mm-hmm.
because it almost completely made the Viet Cong action ineffective. They expended almost all of their resources.
Mm-hmm.
And were soundly whipped. It took a little while after the Tet to get them calmed down,
mm-hmm.
but it completely or nearly annihilated all the Viet Cong forces.
Okay.
Now the NVA was still in effect, but most of them were north, and they hadn't come down yet.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a victory for our forces over there, because it was the last time that they really had any effective action against American troops or the South Vietnamese in country,
mm-hmm.
without the help of the North Vietnamese coming down. And if we'd have closed the trail, mm-hmm. the North Vietnamese wouldn't have been able to come down.
Right, I guess the distinction being, it was definitely a military victory for American forces in Vietnam, but the political repercussions, and Johnson himself deciding not to run for election shortly thereafter, shortly after you arrived in country, an indication that maybe this was a political defeat for the United States.
Already at that time, there were still conflicts and what kind of a war we were fighting over there, whether we were going to fight a defensive war,
mm-hmm.
to merely sit and hold and protect the South Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
or were we going to expand and go after the Viet Cong and the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And those two attitudes swapped several times, 67, 68, and 69.
Mm-hmm. What did you think when you heard Johnson decided not to run for election?
Did it phase you at all? No.
Didn't phase you at all?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, describe your first experiences at Da Nang and when you finally met your unit at Chulai.
Not too much action at Da Nang. I think the first night we got a rocket attack and a mortar attack, and then you found out where the nearest bunker was from where you were sleeping, and you headed for it. Chulai was a beautiful area, probably some of the most pristine beaches I've ever seen. Be a great resort area. But everything was pretty well organized. It was a large, like I say, the largest Army unit in country, and they, plus there was a Navy unit there that had the swift boats that ran the river, and then there were two Marine Air Groups stationed there. So it was a pretty good sized base.
Okay. When you arrived in country, and then also when you arrived at the unit, did you what kind of briefings did you receive in terms of rules of engagement, interacting with the Vietnamese, things like that?
Yeah, we had very little contact with the Vietnamese. Rules of engagement we discussed, and initially the briefings were based on who was where and what your jobs were going to be. Very little contact. I only got off the base one time in July, and that was to look for a Marine that had been kidnapped. But that was the only time I ever got off the base. We had very few Vietnamese workers on the base. Unlike some of the facts, they had Vietnamese girls that cleaned their hooches and stuff. We had none of that. No contact with them. So I had very little contact with them, except at staff meetings with Vietnamese Army officers occasionally.
Now, was the absence of Vietnamese hooch maids, and was that part of the unit policy, or is
that was the unit policy.
Wow. Yeah, they just didn't want Vietnamese on the base.
Yeah. It was easy to get mortar coordinates and stuff and rockets. Right. And right. Unlike bases out of the country, we'd get rocketed and mortared maybe three or four times a week, in the middle of the night.
So what about barbers? That was a common Vietnamese barbers. Did you have a Vietnamese barber in your compound?
I guess we did at the BX. I think there was one. Yeah.
Okay. That seems to be a commonplace feature. Of most
the
of
BX on the base employed locals.
Okay. Was there any suspicion while you were there that the few Vietnamese that who were employed, that they were Viet Cong?
It could have been. I just stayed away from them, and like I say, if one was a barber and I got a haircut, then I was as close as I ever got to him.
Okay. All right. Why don't you describe the first mission you went on with the unit there?
I wrote a story about one of them, but the first couple of missions are just orientation. You're out trying to find where all the units are and getting familiar with the train. Mm-hmm. The train around July, you started with a low beach area. Then you went into rice paddies, and then you got into mountains, and then over the mountain range, then was triple canopy jungle. So you had all kinds of terrain, and you needed to be familiar with it. And of course, no nav aid, so you had to figure out how to get to different locations in bad weather at night, and so on. But my first mission by myself was Easter Sunday, 1968, and I was working along the river, and there was an army company that was going to move through a village, and they called me and wanted me to go down and look the village over. They said it looked kind of quiet, and they were suspicious, so I went down and made a couple of low passes and didn't see anybody, and I told the company commander, I said, well, that doesn't look good. There should be some people around. I said, there's nobody around. He said, well, we're going to move through, so keep in contact with us. So I orbited overhead. But what was interesting about this unit is all their call signs were from the TV series Gunsmoke. The company commander was Mr. Dillon. One was Chester, and one was Doc, and that was their call sign on the radio. And they started moving through the village, and I can remember all of a sudden ambush broke out, and there was a big firefight. And I can remember this radio operator calling me, and he said, you know, Mr. Dillon's hit, Chester's hit, Doc's hit, we're all hit.
Wow.
So,
do you want to take a minute?
No, it's okay. Yeah. So I called in some gunship support for him, and also some helicopters to evacuate the unit. But they had walked into that good ambush there in that little village, right along the edge of the river. But that was my first experience, and I'll never forget the call signs.
Was that typical in terms of your? This was a special forces unit.
No,
this was just a standard army unit. Okay.
Yeah.
Was that typical? Your interactions with the army units, you would fly those type of missions.
Yeah,
in terms
that was all of it, and that's why I'm saying it was so much different than what the navies and the covers. I mean, every day, if a unit would start moving on the ground, they'd let you know, and then you'd go out and cover for them.
The briefings that you received for those missions, how effective were they in terms of assessing enemy potential enemy contacts, enemy strengths, things, enemy weapon systems, things like that?
Well, of course, their primary fight in VC, unless it was a very big operation, you didn't get involved with the NVA. So the VC were, and you're normally in fairly small groups, so you didn't expect any large group engagement, but normally small group ambushes. But as they moved, as these units moved through, we got a, every day at the brigade, we got a morning briefing on where all our units were, what they were going to do that way, if they were going to move, mm-hmm. where they thought the potential enemy were located, mm-hmm. and then you'd base your flying on that area and stay within radio contact all the time. And then if they got in trouble, they'd call you, and you'd immediately go to that area and support them. Mm-hmm. Call in airstrikes, lots of airstrikes. I've worked targets where they were in contact with as many as eight sets of fighters, eight sets of four, orbiting at altitude, and you're trying to bring them down and mm-hmm. keep track of their fuel and what mm-hmm. they've got in order to put them in, put them in on the targets.
Mm-hmm. Back to that mission you just described, where the unit was ambushed. Did you then bring in some air power?
Yeah, we brought some helicopter gunships in.
Helicopter gunships.
Yeah.
And they came in, dropped their ordnance. Was there another ground patrol that went into that village afterwards to assess the situation?
No, not that particular day. They may have later on, that I'm not aware of. But we primarily got that unit out. I directed them to the nearest little landing site where we get to pick up choppers in. Mm-hmm. And they went in and evacuated them. Mm-hmm.
Was anybody killed?
There was one or two killed. Company commander lost a leg, and a couple of the other ones were wounded.
Mm-hmm. And what size unit, American unit, actually went to that?
It was the American unit, and there were probably 30 people in
that
platoon.
Group, yeah. Okay. Any idea what size unit they came in contact with?
Probably 20, okay. I would guess.
Just a good ambush.
Yeah. And it was ambushed from both sides, along the river and then in the jungle on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
We worked a lot with LRP teams. I don't know whether you're familiar with those, Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol.
Mm-hmm.
I worked one. And that was another group that you had to keep track of each day, where they were inserted.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't give away their position, so you had to be very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few friends that I got to know that were in LRP teams, and I used to bug them because they'd always whisper at you. And I'd whisper back, and that would make them mad because, you know, they're in the jungle. They don't know where the VC is, so they're on the radio, and they're whispering, and I'd whisper back at them, and they'd get mad and tell me to speak up. But I checked in, and I got a call from one group one day, and they said they needed to get for me to get them out of there, that they were bee stung. And I don't know what he was talking about. And they'd run into a bee tree.
Oh my goodness.
I think five or six of them, I can't remember now. But they had got stung up so bad that none of them could see. Their faces were all swollen. And they dropped their weapons. They panicked when they...
Yeah.
So they didn't know where their weapons were. They didn't know where they were.
They couldn't see.
So I found a clearing not too far away from them. And the only thing I could do is I'd make several passes around, but then I'd make a pass, or I said, okay, now this is the way to go. And I'd make a pass over them toward the clearing, so they'd start moving that way. And finally got them into the clearing and got a chopper in to pick them up.
Wow.
But they were in bad shape, and they couldn't see. Their eyes were swollen shut, and faces.
That's horrible.
And that was a weird one.
Yeah, I'd never heard of anything like that.
And that was another group of people that you had to keep track of, in addition to all the Army units and the Special Forces camps, and you had to keep track of these alert patrols. And occasionally we'd put in night ambush patrols. In fact, at one time, I went in the chopper, and we put in a five-man team that was going to set up a night ambush not too far from Duck Poke.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to go over a mountain range to get them in. So the next day we got a call from them that during the night one of them had gotten up to relieve himself, and one of the other guys saw him and shot him, and the guy that did the shooting then went berserk because he killed one of his buddies. So they had to want to extract the team. Well, there was a big storm rain and about a 100-foot ceiling right down in there, and they wanted us to go back and get them out before they got exposed. So I went with the chopper pilot, because I'd gone with him the first time, and they thought I could help him. And when he went back in, it was so bad that we were right on the treetop, and we'd go up the side of the mountain right on the treetops, and when they get to the top, we'd turn around and back down the other side, staying along the treetops, because that was the only way he could see where he was going. So we went in and evacuated and took the two of them out. The other three decided they wanted to stay in the ambush, so they stayed another night.
Wow. Did they make contact, you know?
I think they did.
A real quick question. You brought up the bees, and that's a kind of interesting issue. Were there any other problems with wildlife in your unit, amongst either that you had or other members of your unit had, besides that one incident with the bees?
No.
You know, tigers or anything like that?
No, I saw a lot of water buffalo and deer.
Yeah.
But I saw any tigers, a few snakes.
No snake bites?
A few snakes. I never heard of anybody getting snake bit.
Okay.
Never heard of any of that.
Okay. Well, just out of curiosity, you mentioned that one of the, of course, your primary mission, your primary role was to direct all the air power that was in the area. And you mentioned that at times you'd have up to, you know, several teams of aircraft just waiting to bring ordnance on target. Did you find, or did you use both Navy and Air Force air? And if so, did you find that there were any differences or issues, different issues that you had to deal with, with each other, with each one of those, Navy versus Air? Air Force.
We use Navy, Air Force, and Marines, a lot of Marines.
Okay.
But really, you went by aircraft as far as what you knew what kind of capabilities each aircraft had.
Mm-hmm.
And that would determine how close you'd put in ordnance to your troops on the ground, depending on the airplane.
Okay.
For example, the F-100, you could put napalm in very close to friendlies. They were very accurate with napalm. If you wanted high drag bombs, 750-pound bombs close, then you'd want to use an F-4 if you had it, because they were accurate with their high drags. And then strafing F-4s and 100s were good.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the airplanes the Marine had, the A-6s and A-4s, they were good, but they were very limited in how much. The A-4s were very limited in how much ordnance they could carry, so they expended their ordnance pretty quick, and they weren't really effective in certain target areas.
Mm-hmm.
The only airplane that I had trouble with was the A-7. When they first got over there, they just come out with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably a good airplane, but the pilots weren't that familiar with it, and so they weren't quite as good. And we put in bombers, B-57s, low, and a few 105s from up north. When they got diverted, we'd come down and we'd put them in. We did not like to put the 105s in. Anybody that was used to going north didn't want to go low, and we didn't want them dropping bombs from 5,000 feet. We wanted them down on the deck where we could see them.
Yeah.
And the B-57s and the Canberras dropped a little high, probably from 3,000 feet, and we didn't like that too well, because you give them a mark at a target, and you got troops anywhere nearby, and it's a long flight time with the bombs, and you sit there and watch them go, and you're not sure where they're going to go. So you were selective on the types of aircraft, not what service was flying them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But what about the reason I ask? I interviewed a gentleman back, and he mentioned that one of the problems or one of the issues that he had to juggle was Air Force. Jets would come in heavy on fuel, and sometimes they have to leave them burning their fuel because they would get resupplied, refueled in the air, whereas Navy aircraft would come in low on fuel because they're coming in from their aircraft carriers, and so you gotta get the Navy guys in to drop their ordnance because they don't have very much loiter time, and you got Air Force guys that are actually they have too much fuel, and they can't effectively conduct the mission until they burn some of it off. I was wondering if you ever ran into those types of issues.
No, whenever fighters checked in with you, the first thing you ask was what's your fuel state.
Okay.
And once they told you what their fuel was, then regardless of who they were, you stacked them up depending on what their status. Some you might have three or four sets stacked up, and another flight would check in and low on fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd hold these guys, and you'd put that one in right away.
Mm-hmm.
You hated to send anybody back home with ordnance.
Right.
So you try,
because they'd have to drop it in the water, especially if they were Navy, before they landed.
Yeah.
So, okay. Was there a particular aircraft or was there a particular ordnance you preferred to have on hand for jungle fighting?
Yeah, you like napalm, and you like 750-pound hydrides. Uh-huh. And then, of course, you used a lot of strafe. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. I've and had them put in 2,000-pounders and make big holes in the ground. But primarily when you're supporting ground troops, you don't need anything that big. You want something accurate and something that can do a lot of damage.
Now, you said the 100s were good at napalm, correct?
That was my favorite.
What made them better at dropping napalm than the Air Force?
Well, it was the aircraft a little more stable, maybe at low. I flew 100s, and they're pretty stable when they get down below. It's hard to say.
Did you fly F-4s as well? Or?
No, I didn't. Okay. I never flew F-4s, but they were, and the best all-around fighter pilot I ever put in was flying an F-4.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But some of them, in, you know, just depended on, primarily, I think, on the aircraft rather than what branch the pilot was.
Mm-hmm. Well, how close could you bring an F-4 with 750-pound drag?
Well, 100 meters.
100 meters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because
and what
you
about
get shrapnel. Napalm you bring in to 50. But you get shrapnel flying from the 750, so you didn't want to bring them in close.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, those were the rules you tried to go by. Sometimes when guys on the ground are throwing hand grenades at each other, and they're begging you to get those guys and all.
Right.
And like I say, I brought in a set with napalm one time, and I had to. Our guys marked their spot, and I knew where the bad guys were, and I said, "You're too close, move back." So he said, "Okay." Then he called me about 5 minutes later, and he said, "Okay, we've moved back." And then we put in the napalm, and then I said, "Okay, give me another mark on your position." And he hadn't moved a foot.
Did that happen a lot?
Not a lot, but they were extremely confident on the accuracy of the fighter planes. Sometimes too confident.
More confident than you were.
Yes.
But at the same time, you said that there were no friendly casualties as a result of support that you brought in on target.
We had one short round in 11th Brigade in the whole year that I was there, and that was from a B-57, and he was dropping pretty high.
Uh-huh.
And he had a short round. Some of the biggest problems, you were the boss, and you'd have to tell the fighters how to run on the target.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes to them, the way you wanted them to run on the target was not a good way to run. Sometimes into a mountain, sometimes down over the top of a mountain. But they didn't realize that there were friendlies left and right, and they couldn't run the other way.
Right.
And sometimes you'd get into arguments on, and you'd tell them, well, you run it the way I tell you, or you don't run, you go home with your bombs, because you're not dropping unless you run on. I sent a wing commander home one time. I dropped the rest of his flight. It was 2, 3, and 4 both dropped, but he wouldn't run it the way I wanted him to do, so I sent him high and dry, and I put the rest of the flight in. But, you know, you got friendlies, and to them, that might be the best way to run the target, but they don't know where the people are on the ground.
Right, and you don't have time. You've got guys on the ground that are taking fire, and they need some help.
Yeah.
And you haven't got time to sit there and explain every single thing to
brief the target. That's what the first thing you do is you brief the target to the to the flight.
Yeah.
And it helps if you've got some stacked up, they're all listening, so they're paying attention.
Right.
And you brief them, and you tell them where the friendlies are, and then you swing in and you mark the target.
Mm-hmm.
You make sure they identify where you've marked, and then you tell them what direction you want them to run. And this particular flight with that wing commander, I briefed him, and he came in, and here he comes the other way, and I said, go high and dry, you're not clear. And so he pulled up, and he said, that's the only way to run it. And I said, well, you go high and dry, and if the rest of your flight wants to run it the way I'm briefing it, they can. But that happens occasionally.
Was there a particular... did you find that more amongst Air Force pilots versus Navy versus Marine, or was it kind of across the board?
Oh, I think across the board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any pilot's looking at a target on the ground, and he knows what looks to him like the best way to run the target.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them, the only way you could run the target was pretty hairy, and you'd tell the guy, you know, if you don't want to run it, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only way we can drop the ordnance, is to run it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And 99 times out of 100, they'd say, fine, we'll do it. You know, got very sudden, did you ever get any static? I've only sent that one guy high and dry the whole year.
Okay. In terms of hitting your smoke, how difficult and did you have much problem with getting guys to adjust off your smoke if your smoke was not necessarily directly on target?
Not usually. You'd get irritated sometimes. We only had, you had 16 rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes about half of those wouldn't be operational. In other words, the firing pins would be broken off. So you'd only have half that many loaded to start with. So you're going to fly 4 hours and you maybe put in 8-10 sets of fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So you only mark so many times. Then you run out of smoke.
Right.
And so sometimes you'd get irritated if you had a couple of flights holding and they wouldn't be paying attention to where you were marking. Or you'd mark and a leader say, well, I didn't catch that mark. We'll mark again. Well, you only have so many.
Right.
And then you get down, when you run out of the rockets, then you're down to, you know, 50 feet off the ground trying to drop a smoke grenade out the window, and that gets that a little more difficulty in being accurate. So
mm-hmm.
The biggest problem was trying to conserve your smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, on a target, you try and get napalm in first.
Okay.
Because if you could get something burning on the ground, then you had a mark that was better than your smoke. And so that's what you try to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the same thing at night, too. If you put in targets at night, you couldn't see the smoke at night. So you drop log flares, and you get a log flare going, and then you try and get some napalm in or something that would get burning.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had another mark that you could vector from. They were pretty good.
Okay. The reason I ask, I heard talking to a couple of the gentlemen yesterday, and they'd mentioned that there seemed to be, a good way to put it, smoke fixation, where the pilots coming in would fix on the smoke, where the smoke was, and ignore the adjustments and just drop the ordnance right on the smoke.
I never ended that problem.
Okay.
Then normally you give them a position. Of course, the secret was to be as accurate as you could with your smoke.
There you go. Right.
But lots of times you'd put your smoke in, and then the situation would change,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have to move them.
Okay.
You know, or the ground guy, our troops would say, "Okay, they're moving back this way. We need to adjust," and then you'd have to adjust from there.
Okay. What did you use? Yeah, you flew these. These were O2s that you were flying. What did you use as a sight for your smoke rockets?
And you take a grease pencil and make a mark where you knew on the windshield for where you sat in the seat.
Okay.
Yeah, that was inside.
Same thing for the O1.
Yeah, and then when you drop the smoke grenades, it's when you'd be 50 feet off the ground, and when your left wheel passed over the target, and then you drop the smoke grenade.
Okay. Did you ever employ Skippy bombs? The grenades in Skippy peanut butter jars?
Yeah. In fact, I had my mother sent me a couple of boxes of pint jars.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Okay. And that was, again, just a mechanism of close air support, or was that for the smoke grenades as well?
No, that was for primarily just support for troops on the ground if they got in trouble. You could get behind where the bad guys were and
mm-hmm.
start dropping grenades on them.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to have the jar, otherwise they'd explode in the air.
Right. When you had to do that, did you find that to be somewhat effective? I mean, did you get feedback from the guys on the ground that, hey, this was really messing up the enemy, making them take cover and everything else, and it gave them time to withdraw or whatever?
I had, there was a patrol of about six people that had a VC with him, and he was going to show them a ammo stash,
mm-hmm.
and they had to forge a river, and it was a first squadron, first cav, and they had the armored personnel carrier that couldn't cross the river, so they had to stop at the river.
Mm-hmm.
These guys forded the river, and they kept calling me and said, this guy says it's just a little bit further, just a little bit further. And finally, they got a little ways away from the river, and they got into an ambush. And they took off, and I dropped some grenades that way. There was about 10 VC chasing these five down the trail.
Mm-hmm.
And used up all my Willy Peets and all my smoke rockets, run them off trail. But I'd fire a couple of them, and they'd get off the trail, and I'd give the guys a little more time
mm-hmm.
running away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd go into a side forward slip and fire my M16 out of the window, and I'd get them off the trail.
Mm-hmm.
And then I dropped a few of the grenades with the pint jars.
Mm-hmm.
And they got back across the river.
And
they met me at the club that night.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't buy any drinks there. They were pretty happy that they got back to their
mm-hmm.
armored personnel carriers.
Why don't you go ahead and describe, you mentioned earlier that there was a time where you were actually on the ground fighting. Why don't you describe the events leading up to that and how that came about and the action itself?
Well, several times we'd go in to evacuate wounded, and many times we couldn't get the dust off helicopters to come in
mm-hmm.
because the ground fire was too heavy and they wouldn't come in without gunships. So the brigade commander would take his command and control chopper in and evacuate wounded out of that. And many times the dead and the wounded that he was evacuating filled up the chopper. And so there were two or three of us that were with him, and we'd get off and we'd stay on the ground.
Yeah.
And several times, one time he didn't get back for 2 days. The chopper broke down after he got back, and so we spent... And we got... the VC attempted to overrun. It was on a little hill, and the VC attempted to overrun the hill during the night, and we had to fight them off. But there were several cases like that.
Do you remember where that particular incident occurred, or when?
I sure don't.
Okay. What unit were you with at that point?
I was with the 11th Brigade, but I don't know what the company was or what battalion it was.
Right. Did the unit sustain any casualties that night when the enemy tried to overrun it?
Yeah. It was interesting when the little guys that were trying to overrun it started off with SAPTRA charges, and we had some perimeter wire, and they got through there. But none of them had any weapons. They had knives and the SAPTRA charges, but no other weapons.
Wow.
We killed three or four of them. And,
anybody wounded in your unit?
Yeah, a couple guys.
From the SAPTRA charges?
Not from the SAPTRA charges, but a couple of them got stabbed, and they got into bunkers and got the guys. But I don't know whether they were afraid of losing what weapons they had if they didn't get back out, you know. But they didn't. And plus, I may figure they travel a lot faster. But they were primarily throwing grenades and satchel charges.
It sounds like a suicide mission almost.
Yeah.
You know, to penetrate a position with nothing but satchel charges, grenades, and a knife. I mean, and getting into a bunker where you know the Americans you're going up against have rifles.
They weren't really bunkers. They were just kind of dug in foxholes. Everything was very temporary. So I think they probably thought that, you know... they had a pretty good chance of penetrating. I don't know whether they thought so. Maybe some senior staff was there and they could get. But.
Wow. Well, what was the biggest difference? And go ahead and discuss if you will, your transition from being in the AmeriCal down to the 11th Light Infantry. When did that transition occur when you went from the AmeriCal to the 11th?
I was in country about 2 months. And, of course, the AmeriCal division had the whole area. And then each brigade had four FACs assigned to it, and there were three brigades. So, and then the first squadron, the first CAV, was assigned to that unit, and they had the beach area along the lowlands, along the coast. When you're assigned to the division, really, what you are, there's about four people that are assigned a division, and they're there to cover any big action that comes up that they can help support it. When you start flying, you've got a big battle going on. They're pretty familiar with the whole area, and they can come out and help an individual brigade that needs additional support. And then also when guys are on R&R and they're gone, they'll fill in and fly missions in that particular brigade. Then when you get with the brigade, then you get more specialized and know the units a little better.
Okay. Now, well, when you were flying these missions, when you were both the assistant division, ALO, and then as the site commander, the ALO and site commander for the 11th Flight, did you feel that the training you'd received here at Hurlburt, that they had done a good job of preparing you for the types of missions you were conducting in Vietnam? Or did you look back and say, boy, I wish they had talked about this or that or the other thing?
I don't think they knew, you know. I mean, like I said, you know, we had... FACs training us here, but the FAC missions in country were so different depending on where you were, what you were doing, that I don't think I ever ran into anybody in the training operation that had been into a situation that I got into where I spent that much time close to the unit.
Wow. So the FACs, how about, would you think that perhaps the training here was more suited to the FACs? Like you had mentioned, the Cubby FACs who had flown missions in Laos and Cambodia, some in North Vietnam.
I think so.
The guys that weren't really interacting with men on the ground, but instead were just kind of doing trail watch and things of that nature.
Yeah, I think when the program was started here, I don't think they envisioned the close air support that we really did, how integrated we were with the Army units on the ground.
Okay.
You know, in theory, you could say, okay, here's an Army unit here, and here's the bad guys here, and they're going to call you and ask you for help. But, you know, what they don't realize is you've been tracking that unit for weeks and weeks, and you know where they've moved, and you know where the bad guys are moving. So you've you followed the whole scenario. So it's not just like they called you out of the box and say, okay, there's something, you know, here they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was any deficiency in the training. I just think nobody had had that experience.
Right. Which, okay, yeah. But for, it seems kind of odd to me, just from the standpoint of, by 67, FACS had to have been flying close air support missions with American
yeah.
units. And I just wonder if eventually that made its way back to
the
training.
I'd
be interested in tracking to see
yeah.
when that finally did make it in, the Hurlburt training in particular.
Yeah.
But that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think the Hurlburt training was, you know, maybe behind the time a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Took a little bit more time for to reach here.
That's like here, you know, mm-hmm. I went through Hurlburt. I trained in the 01.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's what I thought I was going to fly in. And I got in country, all of a sudden I'm checked out in 02, you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't know that out here, you
right.
know, so that they were lagging behind.
What did you think about the difference between the two, the 01 versus the 02, or the 02 versus the 01?
Well, the 02 was a much better airplane for the mission.
Mm-hmm.
I had instructed in the 01 for about 3 years, so I had a lot of time in it,
mm-hmm.
and I could fly it better than most of the instructors out here, and I was looking forward to going into combat in an airplane that I was very capable in.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got in country, I got checked on the 02. But the 02 was, you know, you had two engines.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get home on the front one by itself, but you could get home on the back one by itself. And,
okay.
And so it was a little more stable airplane.
Mm-hmm. I heard a gentleman describe a story last night where he said that there was a debate, I guess, amongst a lot of FAC pilots, which was better. And apparently, some FACs thought the 02 wasn't as good an aircraft. And he described a 60-degree bank where the pilot he was flying with made this huge bank and eventually stalled the aircraft. And they were, of course, plummeting towards the earth. I was wondering if you had any hairy experiences with the 02 yourself.
It's any airplane, if you overstress it. First of all, the 02 was a good airplane,
mm-hmm.
except it had about 10 times as much weight in it as supposed to because of all the radios in it. And so when we flew, we didn't carry parachutes, we didn't carry an extra person. You talk about a lot of these guys were flying with two people. The only time we ever took an extra person was at night, somebody to read the map. But during the day, you never carried anybody with you. You didn't carry a parachute because you didn't want any extra weight. That whole back of that airplane was full of radio equipment, so it was very little. And in fact, you're supposed to have two rocket pods on each side. We only carried one on each side because of the weight.
So do you think would you consider that it was somewhat underpowered then for the mission that it was trying to perform
in
country?
No, it was overloaded by
the
Air Force.
Okay,
and
well, that's a good distinction.
Yeah, it was a good airplane, and the 01, that was a maneuver we used to teach the Army. You turn it in a tight, steep turn and stall it out, and it'd go into a spin.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd do it over the top, or you could do it on the bottom, but mm-hmm. any airplane would do that if you overload it. And, of course, the OV-10 was a nice-looking airplane, and everybody loved it. But it was some of the guys thought it was a fighter, and they weren't really fat. They were trying to get in on the war themselves.
Hmm.
And that distracted, I think, a lot from FAC and free ground. You know, you were supposed to bring in fighters and support. They
right.
had the big ordnance.
Right.
And I've heard stories of so many of the OV-10 pilots that I think, well, I can handle this myself. You know, I can go in and I can get the bad guys. And instead of facking, they were trying to be a fighter pilot. And I think that's one disadvantage of the OP-10.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a much higher performance aircraft. Mm-hmm. But that was why everybody was leery on going to it. That's why they quit facking in some of the other airplanes. You know, they used to fack in the F-100. But it was too fast, and they the FAC decided, I'm going to do some strafing. I'm gonna,
mm-hmm. And the OV-10, the ordnance that they carried with them, what did that include usually?
They could carry a lot. They had miniguns, they had explosive rockets. They could carry a 1,000-pound bomb in that center line, and a couple of smaller bombs. And some of them would load up, you know, when they'd go out, and that's what they would do.
Yeah, that would be quite a distraction for a FAC.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was the theory of not using the 100 anymore and going to the 02.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I first went over, I was supposed to fly half a tour, 6 months in the 100,
mm-hmm.
and then 6 months as a FAC.
Okay.
And then they quit using the 100s as FACs, and then they also decided that it took you 6 months to learn how to be a FAC.
Mm-hmm.
So it was wasn't very smart to do a six-month tour and then swap. So. Mm-hmm. And they're right. It took you 6 months to be a good guy. You had so many things you had to keep track of. Night missions were the wildest. We didn't like night missions. Because first of all, Charlie didn't start anything at night unless the weather was bad. So you ended up in bad mm-hmm. weather and back in the jungle and back in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're trying to locate the people on the ground. Once you find the friendlies on the ground, then you find the bad guys on the ground in the pitch dark. And then you get a flare ship, and he's orbiting up here, and he's going to drop flares for you. And then you get a gunship. He comes in. He's going to help you out. Then you go out four or five sets of fighters all orbiting up here, and you've got to direct all them in, plus find the guy on the ground. And it used to be funny that you've got them all at different altitudes, and they sometimes wouldn't trust us. And they'd ask each other, what altitude are you at? What altitude are you at? And one of them would say, turn on your lights. I'm going to see where you're at. And the guy would say, no, you turn on your lights. You turn on your lights, you're going to get shot. So they'd keep asking us as facts to reassure them that we had separation on all the flights.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd work from there. It would be a gaggle at night sometimes. With a gunship and a flare ship and a bunch of fighters.
Mm-hmm.
It used to get kind of wild.
Would you carry flares at night in an O2?
No, you carried log flares. It looked like one of those artificial logs you burn in your fireplace.
Okay.
And you hung one on each wing. And you'd drop that, and it'd burn for about 15 minutes on the ground after you drop it.
Okay.
And that's what we carried. That's what we
carried. Okay. What were some of the incidents that you endured as a pilot where you were getting shot at?
Well, I got shot at most every day.
Okay. What were the most hairy experiences?
One of the funniest ones was there was a big firefight going on in on the top of a ridge, and I was putting in airstrikes, and every time I'd go in to mark the target, I'd get shot at with a 50 caliber.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally, after a couple passes, I figured out if I got down below the top of that ridge, they couldn't depress the 50 cal on me, so they weren't hosing me down. So I stayed below the ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'd do is orbit down below the ridge, and then after each fighter would come in, I'd go back up. If they had to have a mark or something, I'd go back up, and then I'd go back down. And when I got back to Chew Line, they were refueling the airplane, and the crew chief came in, and he was upset. And he said, I don't mind patching the bullet holes. He said, but this is ridiculous. And he said, come on out. So I went up and climbed up and looked on the top of the wing, and there were 30 shrapnel holes in the top of the wing, all along, some of them, you know, the size of your fist. And he said, I don't know what you've been doing. He said, but this is ridiculous. And come to find out that when they were dropping the hydrag bombs on the top of that ridge, and I was orbiting down below, the shrapnel was coming. I thought I was taking ground fire.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So I decided that I, you know, was the worst of two evils, either that or the 50 cal. So I, but that was the worst I ever tore up an airplane, I think. Got shot up a couple times with an engine go out, and you could limp back on the, you, in fact, you could hold altitude with the back engine on, but you couldn't hold altitude on the front engine. So you always hoped that if you lost the back engine, you didn't have a mountain range to go over.
Mm-hmm.
Limped back a couple times like that. Some of my hairiest experience, I went down five times flying in as a right door gunner in that those choppers.
Mm-hmm.
And one time we got shot up pretty bad, we were on fire, and the plane was burning and spinning, and another kid and I jumped out about 30 feet off the ground into a rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way down I kept thinking, I got to do the parachute roll on a hit. But you can't do a parachute roll when you land in mud in a rice paddy up to your knees. So I tore up one of my knees. And a couple other times. One time we went down to pick up a VC in a field, and he threw a hoe up through the tail rotor, and that sent us down. But overall, we went down five times with different problems.
In the choppers?
In the chopper, yeah. A couple times we spent the whole day and the night on the ground, mm-hmm. or another would keep them and get us.
Mm-hmm.
It was,
now what choppers would you fly?
These were Hueys. Okay. Just a straight old Huey.
Okay. And how did you find yourself being tasked to be a door gunner on a Huey?
It was, I enjoyed it. I had a couple of facts that didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. The crew chief was the door gunner on the left side.
Yeah.
And I was on the right side.
On the right, yeah.
And the brigade commander usually sat in the middle with his intelligence officer. And that was it. And I'd go out and check everything.
Okay.
But I'd gotten pretty good with the M60. When we trained at Fort Lewis, Washington, we had a bet with the Army guys and this other Air Force guy and I. They challenged us.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to pick the weapons. So the first sergeant had taught us how to fire the M60 from the hip, and he didn't tell these Army officers. So we showed up at the firing range to have this shootout.
Mm-hmm.
They thought we were going to use pistols. They're 45s against our 38s. And we pulled out the M60 machine gun, and he said, from the hip, Rambo, John Wayne style.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd gotten pretty good at it. The first sergeant had trained us for a couple of days. And so we won quite a few beers. So I was pretty good with that, with the M60. And then I flew about three or four missions with the Blue Ghost, who were the choppers that were assigned, gunships assigned to cover the first squadron and the first cab.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew as the right door gunner with them for a couple of days. And that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a couple of days out in the field with the first squadron and the first cab, and then the personnel carriers. That was interesting. I spent a couple days going up the river with the Navy and their swift boats, and that was always interesting. Those guys used to always beg us for targets, and like I told you, we were the only ones that could get a target, so they'd have their swift boat up the river, and they'd want a target. So you'd look around and try and find something for them. Normally you couldn't find anything worthwhile, but once in a while you would. But they'd fire their mortars from the swift boats, but then that was funny because they wanted to be 50 meters and then 50 meters short, and he'd say, okay, now try and fire it on the same rock of the boat, you know, so and they're firing that mortar. So.
Oh, yeah. Not a very stable platform.
No, so they'd like to have a target to shoot at.
Uh-huh.
Then I got to go out to the New Jersey. We were the first ones to put in the New Jersey, so we flew out in the chopper and briefed the skipper of the New Jersey and how we were going to work and put in quite a bit of their artillery. They were very interesting to put in because they'd fire, and then two or three minutes later, you'd get a shell coming in because they were so close that they were having to fire almost straight up, you know, and they'd hit the targets on them. And that was very nerve-wracking because you'd fire, and then you're trying to observe, and you're trying to stay out of the line of fire and watch to see where they're hitting. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't like to do that anymore. We had to.
How frequently would you bring in naval gunfire? As a fact.
I probably only did it five or six times the whole time I was there. And I don't know whether New Jersey moved someplace up the coast or something, but it was just about 2 weeks or something that we worked it. I got some pictures of my trip out to the New Jersey, but we didn't work with them a lot.
Would you also bring in artillery fire?
Yes, and that was the same with artillery. I did not like to put in artillery. I kind of let the Army do their own artillery. I didn't like to do artillery. One of the problems with the triple canopy jungle is very difficult to see where it's hitting sometimes. And you had to know where your fire bases were, where it was coming from. Then you had to know the millimeter of the guns they were shooting and what the tracking time. They'd normally give you a track time. They'd say, you know, 30 seconds, a minute, or whatever it was. And then they give you a fire time, and you could hack them and you could stay out of the road. But I did not think, personally, it was that accurate.
Okay.
So I didn't put in any more artillery. Once in a while I had to, but I didn't like to. I wouldn't put it in close to the good guys because I didn't trust the accuracy of them.
Mm-hmm. In either the naval gunfire support or the artillery support you brought in, were there any friendly casualties as a result of that
or
any short rounds or anything like that?
Okay. And that's because we didn't put them in close.
You
put them into suspected build-up areas, suspected VC camps or storage areas and things like that.
Now these the aspects of being a FAC in terms of determining, you know, what you want to be careful of and what's the closest you want to bring a certain ordnance and, you know, with certain aircraft and things like that. Was that something that you learned OJT, or was it briefed to you by other FACs? You know, how did you discover, you know, you F4s are great at 750-pound bombs, but if you want to bring napalm, it's the 100s. You know, you got to be careful, naval gunfire, artillery. How did you pick these things up as you went along?
Maybe somebody mentioned it along the line, but I don't recall. It was kind of OJT. You kind of learned as you went along. first time you put in artillery and you pinpointed the coordinates for you and you saw they weren't hitting exactly where those coordinates were, then you said, you know, I'm going to watch this. Next time I'm going to put them, see if that's a, this is a rarity or if this is norm. And you, and that's, like I said, it took you about 6 months to learn to, to be a fact, to learn how to fact.
To be a good fact.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, you could go up there and stay hit. And you, in most cases, you, well, you, sometimes you'd have to go in. But, you know, you could coast. Some of the facts could, and not look for trouble, and stay out of trouble that way. But if you got in a nitty gritty, you had to know what you were doing.
I assume by your statement that there were some who did.
There's some who did. You know, I'm sure.
Human.
I'm sure some of the males and the cubbies would get up, and some of the guys would just bore holes in the sky. You know.
But it wasn't common.
No, I would say. But it's like I told you, you know, 1% of the troops on the ground never fire their gun. You know, it's what they say. You know.
Did you ever get shot down in an O2?
No. I've went back with an Indian shot up and shot up, but had a bullet bounce off the bottom of my seat. That's probably the closest I ever. But that's the only armor plating we had, was on the bottom seat.
Thank goodness for that.
But it bounced off the ball and rolled around. I still have it at home.
Do you?
Yeah.
What kind of round was it, do you know?
It looked like a 30 caliber.
Okay.
It all shredded off. You know, the only, all it is the inside core.
But, what was the heaviest thing you were hit with? Was, you mentioned earlier 50 cal.
And 37 millimeter.
37 millimeter?
Occasionally with 37 millimeter.
Okay.
RPGs sometimes, or rockets, handheld rockets, when they fire those at you.
Oh, yeah.
You could avoid those. 37 millimeter was the, probably the worst that we had. And it could, and that's not really bad. I mean, it, that was, we didn't have the, they didn't have the big stuff like they had further north. And that's why we had trouble getting some of the guys that were used to going north, some of the fighter pilots, to come down and go at low altitude. We had a lot of small arms fire, we could get you down. We had a funny incident. We'd flying into Duck Fort with a chopper every night. We'd get shot at every night coming in. And this guy was in a hooch down there behind us. And finally, about the second or third time, I said to the brigade commander, go get that guy. He said, no. He said, that guy can't hit anything. If you're killing, they're liable to put somebody there that can hit. So we never went after him. I just left him alone. But he'd shoot at us every time.
And he never hit you.
No.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. All right, just one last question real quick. Part of the interview process, of course, involves the release of our copyright control over this to the Texas Tech University Vietnam Archive. But for the purposes of distributing the oral history interview and transcripts to anybody who might be interested, this in no way restricts your story or your ability to write your story to distribute it for the purposes of books, magazines, movies, you know, whatever. It's not a restrictive agreement. It is just giving us permission to release the interview to patrons who come to the archive. Would you be willing to agree to that, that type
agree
of
to that.
System? Thank you. Okay, I agree to it as well. Thank you. All right, this ends the first interview with Colonel William Anderson.